I thought it might be better to continue a little bit with the thing that we set the stage for by sort of an introduction last night on seeing that dimension of life which is often not seen by us in the infinitely small and infinitely beautiful, the impressive structures as well as the awe-inspiring beauty of crystal forms that were in those photographs last night. As I mentioned last night, a good deal of my life has been spent in relationship to healing, particularly close to the hospital and medical models, though I'm not a medical doctor. The topic of healing, therefore, is one that's always close to me. And now that I've been permitted to retire, I am finding a new kind of an excitement in going back and looking over the things that have transpired in the last 30 or 40 years in my own life, the things that I've been privileged to experience or to see or to witness or to share with others, and to attempt to distill them down into those things that I, in my judgment at least, are the things most significant out of whatever I have been permitted to see or to learn during these years. I don't really know what retirement is. I haven't yet seen any slowing down of activity. I think that retirement, by what I've experienced, and I was wondering what it was going to be like and kind of excited about it, I think all it means is that you're not on a regular income anymore. Fred, you know that that's just about it. I think probably there are others here who are retired and have seen some of the same thing. But it does set us free to examine and look back, to correlate and to collate a little bit, to distill out some of the things that we might want to communicate as those things which, in our own life experience, we have found are significant and that we would like to pass on and to share with others. If I go back to college, high school and college days in the 20s and 30s, it was a very different kind of a world. There have been such fantastic changes that it's extremely hard to even begin to wrap your mind around the significance and the rate and the tempo of these accelerating change patterns that afflict us. And yet perhaps there are some things, and maybe simply because of the enormous technological advances and the great amassing of knowledge at accelerated rates, maybe it becomes even more important that we shake things down and winnow things out and look for the things that are truly meaningful and significant and perhaps essential to life. Now, I'm going to ask you to do something which I hate to do. I hate to listen to anybody reading a manuscript, but I'm going to ask you to do it because otherwise we'll be here for the next week instead of trying to take it in the shorter version of the written material that I have here. So will you hang on a little bit with me and forgive me for reading this morning? Hey, got people back here, all right. We'll see if there's something here that may be of interest or profit to you. If I go back then into those 20s and 30s when I became kind of conscious of something about life and its values, before that I'd simply been some sort of a sponge soaking up as all children and adolescents are. But someplace, I suppose, when we hit later adolescence and early adult years, we may begin a little bit to reflect on what we are seeing or what we are experiencing. Let me turn the corner back just a bit for a moment. I didn't finish something I intended to say. I am hoping now that in the next whatever months or years may be given to me to come up with a description, at least, if not the operation of, a year or two experience for anybody who may want it, looking at three sets of contrasts in life that add dimensions to our existence and to our living and to our appreciation, as well as to the definition of humanity and personality and of God, most of all of God. And in this little mini-university structure that some have suggested may be the appropriate form, we'll be dealing with something that I put myself through back in the 30s. When I thought that education wasn't serving me very well, actually, as I look back now, I think I served education very poorly. I had a little precedent for it. I failed the fifth grade cold, had to start it all over again in a small town where my dad was the preacher, so I was noticeable and highly visible. Somehow recovered from the trauma of that one, and can even see some humor in it today. The educational process in which I was participating at the time as a student seemed to be more like a kind of a cafeteria arranged on a rapidly rotating Lazy Susan, and you grabbed what you could when you could get it. Maybe because some of your buddies were in the taking biology one or whatever at that time, or because you couldn't fit it in and you had to have something for the fourth hour on Wednesday mornings and or Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So here was one that was convenient. And it seemed to me it lacked a good deal of the necessary orientation and direction and compass points. And so I dropped out of school down in Chicago for a while. And with the help of a very kind professor who had the capacity for being a little bit imaginative and tuning in on my some of my imagination and fantasies and dreams, he set the stage for me to spend 2 weeks with a microscope, doing nothing but looking at a microscope at all kinds of little things, not trying to learn anything. I just wanted to be confronted with the infinitely small. And it was quite a thing to see all these little things moving or swimming or standing still down there in this world below. Well, we touched on that last night somewhat. Now I'm doing it more for the sake of just the beauty of it, as almost like an art form. In contrast to that, then, in contrast to the smallest that God has made, I then spent 2 weeks looking through a telescope every night and talking with and watching the people who had become intimately acquainted with the whirling spheres, at least those that were visible at that time, and that was only a fraction, a tiny fraction, of the ones that are visible and known and understood today because of this enormous technological development that makes our eyes stretch out so we can see, you know, millions of light years instead of just the close proximity that the 1920 telescopes and 1930 telescopes would show us. To see the breadth of God's creation by looking through microscopes and through telescopes in close time juxtaposition was an interesting and I think an enriching experience for me. Just to be conscious of how far and how near God is in itself, I think, very important to life. Then the next set of contrasts was for me then, and will be if we ever get this little thing off the ground, the contrast between beginnings and endings, birth and death, for instance, or sunrise and sunset. We talked a little bit about that last night. In doing this, and in spending a couple of weeks contemplating the beginnings, like meeting new people, or seeing a seed burst through the ground, or watching a sunrise and think a little bit about all the days that have begun since the beginning of time, and that this one is like a new creation, with new opportunities, new splendors, new joys, perhaps new agonies, but another day full of God's grace. That is the one unchangeable thing about the day, is that this day, as was yesterday, and as will be tomorrow, is a day full of grace. Better, I think, more fun at least, if we can take some time to be conscious of and realize that this is indeed a day full of grace. Another thing that became apparent in that experience of these, so far, these two sets of contrasts, was that that it's wrong and erroneous, perhaps, to think in terms of polar opposites, like smallest and largest. They almost lose their significance, particularly in the light of modern technology, the new instrumentation, for instance, where you can look into the molecule and see something not terribly different from what they're seeing out there light years away. They share a remarkable similarity. And that's kind of interesting. It's as though everything is bent around, and smallest and largest lose much of their significance, at least, as they become part of an enormously complicated, awe-inspiring, beautiful, good design. I don't know how big we are. Maybe we're inside of an atom. This has been speculated upon, I think, by philosophers almost every day since the atom was talked about at all. What is a molecule? Where do we stand in relation to it? Maybe we are infinitely small. And I suspect that that's probably closer to the truth than that we are infinitely large, even though some of us are a little bit larger than we ought to be. The final set of contrasts, after thinking of beginnings and endings, and seeing that birth and death are not far apart. To be born is to have a promise of death, in some terms. To die is to have a promise of life, in fantastically significant terms. To know something about the breadth of God's creation, that is the infinitely small and the infinitely large, at least to me, has been one of those things which has helped put a foundation under the gospel, which has, at least at this point, made me unafraid of sundowns and night and of death. But mostly it's because I know so many people who have died, and many of them dying with great courage, and with some with great excitement, that at least it has opened some of my hunger for when the time comes. I suppose I'll squeal and holler and protest and bite and kick and complain about it, like most of us do, and I think probably I will a little bit more. But I hope that leading up to it, at least, I will have some of the excitement of anticipation of dying and wonder what in the world he's got in store next. Because if yesterday was a day full of grace, tomorrow, even if it's the day after, is going to be fantastic. The final set of contrasts was between good and bad. I put myself through that one by trying to find all the bad things I could find in Chicago. And there was enough to find. I rode with a vice squad and we went around. I watched them make raids on gambling houses and on houses of prostitution. Spent a couple of nights in what they call the tank. In the fellowship of a bunch of drunks. I got sick sliding around in the vomit of the place because it was a horrible, horrible place. And they thought I was sick because I was too young to know how to hold my liquor or something. And they didn't realize I was vomiting because of their vomit. That was what was, at the moment, making me sick. But I experienced something that night in the presence of, in those nights, in the presence of those, do we say derelicts, I guess? You know, the skid row kind of a drunk. There was a kind of a concern for me, amounting to a compassion. And it made it possible for me to identify with them as brothers. And I began to somehow or another see that these were not the bad. They may be victims of the bad, and I might be closer to the bad than they, if we're going to use such terms that are probably illegitimate terms. But good and bad are bent around together until, at least at points, it's hard to distinguish what is good and what is bad. And there was a moment, I must remind you, we can't spend much time on that, though it would make a topic, I think, for a day's discussion. But there was a moment when the absolute worst and the absolute best hung together in one moment, in one being, in one form, on a cross. And he who knew no sin had become sin. Well, all right. Let me just use that as kind of introduction. Hang on, because I'm going to read kind of fast, okay? Going back again to those days when I first started to think about this sort of thing a little bit and experience it, and reflecting now on the changes that have taken place. It was a very different kind of a world back there in the 20s and 30s. Our nation was experiencing an era of prosperity, you may recall, in the 20s, and an optimism approaching a national mass euphoria. But there were a few hours in late October, I think the date was the 29th, wasn't it? In 1929.
October 29th, 1929.
When everything came tumbling down for a lot of people, and we were introduced to a concept of failure and despair and became conscious of it. The depression which it triggered was to be a way of life for almost a decade. And the factor that lifted us out of that financial pit was the tooling up for World War II. The frightful agony of those years was climaxed with the dropping of the first atomic bomb, and a new kind of horror was introduced to human life. And it was introduced by us. Back in those days, transoceanic air travel was in the category of foolhardy adventure. Television was unknown. Hey, some of you younger ones here, I'll bet you can't even believe this. Television was unknown. Jet aircraft were only in the minds of some wild-eyed dreamers. There were no transistor radios because there were no transistors. And the have-nots still didn't know what the haves had. We were living closer to the racial attitudes of 1870 than to the civil rights turmoil of the 1960s. The place named Dachau carried no implications of horror. Computers were non-existent. The word smog had not yet been incorporated into our vocabulary. Genetic engineering was conceptualized almost exclusively by the writers of mad scientist fiction, who incidentally had replaced the poets as the prophets. And I think they still hold that position. Many of us would have spent 2 or 3 days even getting to the boat down here from our homes in those days, instead of a few hours either by air or by fast automobile on the freeways. Well, we've come through all of this stuff. Well, you know, no man had set foot on the moon yet. But the change that has been included in all these years brought great, great, great blessings. No person in this room today has been untouched by the rich blessings of technological and other developments during the same period of time. And yet perhaps no generation of man has ever lived through such open, manifest, clear, and visible signs of the evil of which man is capable. If I simply mention a few names like Hitler, Idi Amin, and the Somoza family in Nicaragua. Well, it would perhaps not be too difficult to document the contention that we live in the most troubled era of man's existence. Among other things, we have the dubious distinction of being the first generation to develop the capability of total self-destruction of the whole planet. Ours is a generation characterized by its contrasts. Knowledge is expanding at an unprecedented rate. It is entirely possible that within the next decade, man will double the total knowledge accumulated since the beginning of time. And at the same time, we are becoming increasingly inept in our interpersonal relationships. We know more about things and less about ourselves. This is a generation in which large areas of the world are plagued with the problem of overproduction, while even larger areas of the world are still plagued with the threat or the realization of starvation. We can develop the vehicles for putting a man on the moon, but find it extremely difficult to deliver a cargo of wheat to a starving nation. Medical science has developed knowledge, techniques, and equipment capable of solving so many and such a high proportion of physical problems. But only a tiny fraction of the world's population receive anything like adequate medical care. You see some exciting things that are taking place. The other day I picked up Time magazine, I think it's the current issue. And it says something about, and it was on the news a few days before the time came out, says something about that a case of smallpox that they thought had been eradicated from the face of the earth had been discovered in London the other day. Now a man who has sat right here and who used to live right out here, and a Lutheran missionary, probably is the man most responsible for eradicating or nearly eradicating smallpox from the face of the earth, and he did it in only 4 years. So much so that smallpox, one of the greatest killers even 10 years ago, one of the greatest killers of human beings, now gets special news attention on the evening news and some columns in Time magazine because it's such a rare thing. We thought it was gone and somebody comes up with it, a case of smallpox. Just remember the name of Bill Fagey. He has probably been God's instrument for saving more lives than any other human being in this century. Mostly because he was concerned about some African kids and adults. In America, we are moving relentlessly toward a standard 30-hour work week, only to be confronted with the specter of an unwelcome leisure. We don't know what to do with it. We're just beginning to realize that overwork is less of a problem than underwork. The heroes of the day before yesterday were the explorers and discoverers. The heroes of yesterday were the producers of things and the developers of knowledge. Man lived in the confident expectation that when he knew enough and had enough, he would lead a healthy, happy, peaceful existence. But only the most undiscerning have failed to realize that that bubble has burst. We have made knowledge and things ends in themselves instead of implements of great, magnificent values. We know the meaning of almost everything except the meaning of life. It is towards this end that the best efforts of our generation must be directed if we are to be delivered from chaos and technologically implemented destruction. Our generation could be characterized by its activism. Activism has many motivations. We may be activistic in our desire for possessions and reaching out for things. But I think it is even more likely that our frenzied obsession with being busy arises out of something deeper in man than simply the desire to hold things in his hand or to accumulate the symbols of wealth. There is evidenced in our activism a deep and pervading restlessness, indeed an anxiety, that I believe grows out of the amnesia of modern man. He knows neither who he is nor the answer to the question of the why of his existence. Here in all probability lies one of the deep explanations for our mass anxiety neurosis as a society. Until man finds satisfactory the answer to the question of what is man and to the implications of existence, he will continue to be anxiety-ridden and will employ neurotic activity in the alleviation of his pain. Man is a creature of and for relationship. Herein lies the deepest definition of the purpose of human existence. We exist in order to live in meaningful relationship to others. A life that is turned in on itself can never be fulfilled. Relationship finds its most profound fulfillment when it is three-dimensional in nature. The essential relationship is and has been and always will be that vertical relationship, God to man. From it, we draw both the nature of, the definition of, and the power for the second dimension, our meaningful relationship with our brothers. And furthermore, man is apparently the only being of whom it can be said that he stands in relationship to himself, as though he could stand outside of himself and address himself. Relationship is basically perhaps a matter of attitude. My attitude towards my brother will determine the character of my relationship with him. But my attitude, the attitude itself, will grow out of my self-understanding and self-awareness and self-acceptance. In other words, it is based in my attitude towards myself, and so I must have answered not only the question, the generic question of what is man, I must bring that question nearer. Who am I? I will know my brother in the same terms as I know myself. If I have not yet come to peace with myself, I surely will not be at peace with my neighbor. I will simply use him in my restlessness and my disturbance. An example. You may recall the poet, the English poet A.E. Housman, who wrote so many fine, wondrous things. In the name poem for his little volume, A Shropshire Lad, he describes the joys and the peace and the quiet, the comfort of growing up in rural Shropshire. Every spring he could walk and, you know, go down the same paths and find the same robins building the nest up in the same trees. Or, no, this is a kind of thing. He looked in the eyes of people that he knew. He passed familiar places. The dirt that squeezed up through his toes was the same dirt that was there last year in the mud in the fields. This was comforting. And then circumstances made it necessary for him to move to London. And there was a change. But here, he says, in anguished words, but here on London streets I find no such helpmates, only men. I see in many an eye that measures me the mortal sickness of a mind too unhappy to be kind. Undone with misery, all they can is to hate their fellow man. Until they die, they needs must look at me and wish me ill. What tragic words. But of course the truth of these lines lies primarily within Housman himself. It was, at least in very large measure, his own fear, his own hostility, which he saw reflected in the eyes of his brother, and he projected it into them in a paranoid formulation. And they were probably far less dangerous to him than he was to them in this attitude. If I have learned the truths about my own identity and have therefore been set free to love myself, I will be free to love my fellow man. Christ said, love thy neighbor as thyself. It sounds like a command. It may also be an invitation. He could have stated this axiomatically. You will love your neighbor as you love yourself. And if you hate yourself, it follows that you will also hate your neighbor. The concept of neighbor and brother requires a sense of identification. And in this identification, I am one with my brother and one with my neighbor. And these days, I have a lot more brothers. 5% of all the persons who have ever lived on this planet are alive at this moment. Hugh Keenlyside, the Canadian social scientist, has worked out some interesting and frightening statistics. If at the time of Jesus Christ, there were only two people on earth and they were capable of reproduction and got about it, and if the number of human beings increased, the annual gain by 2% per year, since that time, the world population today, and now hang on and listen, the world population today would be at 143 million billion people. Now, that doesn't mean anything. Maybe this means something. It's 1,025 people for every square feet of land on the planet. Now, maybe if we could make boats so they all got out in the ocean, it'd alleviate that, maybe cut it in half. It'd still be a pretty crowded place. 1,025 people for every square foot of ground on the planet. Now, the only way I could make that mean anything, because I can't imagine 100, there's square crowded in this room, you know. And we got a lot more than one square foot, and we're not 1,025. If you put them average height people on their shoulders, they would be piled, humanity would be piled 1 mile deep over the face of the earth. Now that is at the rate, if since the time of Christ, 2,000 years, the annual rate had been the same as the world's population growth is today, give or take a tiny little fraction of percentage points. We got a lot of brothers, and we may have a lot more. Well, something has to be done about it. Technology has to be addressed at the problems of this. Something has to be done about it. Technology has to be addressed at the problems of this. There is more food available than what we have discovered, even though today we are eating up more food than we are producing on the planet, by about a deficit of about 2%. We're eating up more food in the last 3 years than what we're producing. I think the problem of alleviation of these situations lies not so much in the area, however, of technology and logistics. Man has proved himself immensely capable of problem solving, particularly where technology can be involved. His problem lies essentially in the area of morals. Do we want to? Are we concerned? Are we dedicated? Do we feel obligated? Are we our brother's keeper? The future which we face is filled with ambiguities and fraught with dangers as well as with fantastic opportunity. From whence the prophets for this last quarter century? Who will recognize the nature of the inevitable changefulness and help shape the changes into healing patterns, contributing past wholeness to fullness and abundance of living? I submit that perhaps we who by confession, conviction, commitment, stand somewhat uniquely between the wounds of our brothers and the love of God in Christ Jesus may wish to volunteer for the role of prophet to the new day. And I have, if you'll permit me a moment to take time out and say that I make my plea for prophets and for a spirit of prophecy. Well, I'll skip over some of these things. You'll be glad. Now, one of the things that's taking place to turn a kind of a corner here is a widespread repudiation of what is sometimes called a Cartesian concept of a divisible, compartmentalized man. Now, Descartes sat in a steam room, and I think it's, you know, great that it was in a steam room where it ought to be foggy. And he comes up with a definition of man that kind of echoed the Greek view of man and said that man was composed of body and mind and soul, and, you know, east is east and west is west, and never the twain shall meet, you know. That these were three distinct things, and that's why we have churches standing on one corner over there, and schools on a corner over here, and a hospital standing here, and social agencies standing over here, and they hardly ever talk to each other. They express the fragmentation that grows out of our concept of who we are, and what we are, and of the nature of life, as being capable of fragmentation. and division. So we toss the body over to the doctor and the mind over to the teacher and the soul, horrible misuse of the word, or the spirit to the pastor or the priest or the rabbi. The social worker can take care of our social maladjustments, and the psychiatrist can pick up the emotional disturbance. We contribute only then to man's increased compartmentalization, fragmentation. But we speak, if we speak in the terms of Descartes, in describing the human being, we speak in unbiblical terms. And the Bible is not only a book in which God reveals himself, it is a book in which he reveals man to himself, that is to man. But we have missed the definition somewhere along the line, as we have been seduced by other thinkers away from those truths. Some of you may remember a little book written by Arnie Cirilla. I'm sure, Dr. Sutch, you remember. Arnie wrote a book entitled The Voice of Illness. And in there, he presents a proposition. Arnie is a theologian, and his brother Marty is a psychoanalyst over in Helsinki. But the two of them worked together for a long time. And Marty says that the psychiatrist says that his brother is the better psychiatrist. And Arnie, the theologian, says that Marty, the psychiatrist, is a better theologian. And I think that they're just saying that they're almost symbiotically related in what they think. But they came up with this book that Arnie got the credit for writing. And in there he says that the illnesses of a man often, if not always, reflect the focalization of society's ills into the individual. And as an example, he says, you have to get a little perspective and turn back some years. The perspective he was using here as an example was witchcraft in Salem, Massachusetts, a couple hundred years ago. Now, in those days, it was regarded that the witch was the sick one or the evil one or whatever, huh? No question about it in the minds of most of those people. It was the witch that had to be destroyed, man or woman, burned at the stake to make sure that in that dramatic way, in that ugly violence, the curse of that individual was taken away. Now we're 200 years later. Now who's sick? Was it the witch? No. We hardly give any attention to the witch anymore, and I think appropriately so. It was the society that was sick, and they were sick with a dreadful disease called witchcraft. I wonder, 200 years from now, what will be spoken of as the illnesses of this society that today we see as the illnesses of the individual, but may well be simply the focalization and projection of society's disturbance and illness into the individual. As hypertension, which you're hearing a lot about these days, looms larger and larger as a major disease, or perhaps a deeper cause of a great many of our disorders, we may be moved to redefine illness and accordingly modify the therapy. Some of us have noticed that among researchers in recent years, some of the spotlight has been moved away from such things as virology, though it is still there, as a cause, for instance, of cancer, to include hypertension and its possible dampening effect upon the immunizing mechanisms of the human body. And one might wish then that the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, could become a more vibrant reality. If a significant portion of man's diseases and illnesses grow out of the tensions, worries, anxieties, and fears that he experiences, there seems to be little hope that anyone will arrive in time with social, political, economic, and cultural reforms to substantially alleviate the threat of life on this planet, threat to life on this planet. Perhaps the hope lies in another direction, a more inward direction. We've all seen those individuals who are capable of walking as though constantly in the peaceful eye of the storm. While everybody else seems buffeted by the ferocity of the gale, and threatened by the debris it carries. These seem both related to life on the one hand and detached from its threat of defeat on the other. It is peace that we are in need of, and peace is not found in static escape or in being tranquilized into it. It is found compounded out of many things, but prominent among its footings are an awareness of just who we are, an acceptance of the discipline and responsibility necessary to live meaningfully among our fellows, and a sense of oneness with the whole of our Father's infinite creation. This latter experience, the, some may call a first article experience, if you refer to the three articles of the Apostles' Creed, the neglected article among Lutherans, and I think most Christians. But this latter experience can provide what may be termed a healing ambiguity. At one and the same time, a sense of awe, which is like dread, and of deep, profound joy. And they seem to be different. When awe is experienced alone, it tends to degenerate into simple dread and fear, while joy under such circumstances can become utterly superficial and just defined in terms of happiness. These two, however, these two emotions of awe and joy, experienced together, lie very close to the heart of the religious experience. Isaiah, high and lifted up in that year that King Uzziah died. Woe is me, for I am undone. But finding in that moment that meaning was attributed to his life. Or Peter, down with his nose in the slime of a bottom of a fishing boat, when he saw God in Christ and said, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man." But he got up to walk with Jesus. It may be a sober kind of joy, but profound. You can skip the superficial if the roots of our joy go deep and pervade the center of our beings. And I suppose it could be said that in nothing is our generation more deficient than in its capacity to experience awe and joy. For quite some time, we have recognized the relationship between the concept of health and the concept of wholeness, and have noticed the interesting etymological relationship of such words as holiness or holy and wholeness, health, healing, and surprisingly, sanctification. These are all the same word. Whole, holy, salvation, health. But because of Cartesian influence, we've allowed these words to be separated out, fractured, and we don't see that which may be somewhat hinted, at least, in that Colossians verse, that in Jesus Christ all things are brought, says one version, are held, says another version. In Jesus Christ all things are held together. We should perhaps at this point remind ourselves that even the word like ecology, which is such a common word in our vocabularies these days, every little kid 3 years old, none knows about it. But it springs from a very rich and much larger word than the environmentalists are employing. It comes from a word oikos, which meant house. But the house, to the Greek, was a symbol of totality, of wholeness, of everything. Because it was in the house that they were born, it was the house they died, it was in the house that they laughed, and it was in the house in which they cried. Everything was centered in the house. And so the word had two meanings. That building over there, that's my oikos. But then they spoke of their oikos, their totality, their whole life, their whole living. And that in relationship to the ground upon which they walked, the God whom they worshipped, and the brothers who were their family. There is a sense in which the word wholeness, however, is inadequate as a synonym for health. I could almost wish I could find a blue pencil and go back over all the words that I've spoken in the last 20 years glorifying wholeness. I would like to take some of them back. Those that are written, maybe I can find a blue pencil to take those out of something sometime in the future. Wholeness isn't enough. It just isn't enough. It has some flat sides to it and some deficiencies. The word wholeness may carry connotations of a static situation, while something more alive and growing and dynamic must be implied if we're talking about health. For instance, wholeness may be diagrammatically described as a circle or with a circle. But the concept of fullness, and that's the word, of fullness requires at least a cylinder, some kind of a cup that is ready to overflow and capable of overflowing. And it is that kind of life that Jesus described.
And that's where we get ecumenism.
Of course. Of course. Now, wholeness we can do without. Let me give you an example. Let's say that I, instead of breaking this, I broke a leg. And maybe then, too, they put the cast on too tight, as they happened to with this one. And maybe gangrene set in. Huh? And I go into the hospital, and they their first goal is an interesting one. Their first goal would be to save my leg. That's what they would be thinking. Let's save this guy's leg. Hey, they might say it, because we have to do that to save his life, but most likely they'd be concentrating on that leg, save the leg. But let's say that their first goal was failed, and they didn't get there in time to save the gangrenous leg. So they had to amputate it. Now the goal is moved, you see. The goal is now moved to save his life, save my life. I wouldn't like to. It would be a kind of a dangerous thing for you to come up to me, or for some doctor or some nurse or somebody else to come up to you, or a pastor to come up to me and say, well, you're now whole. Or a woman with a radical mastectomy. Or a person whose eyesight has been taken away. Are we whole? It's hard to think in terms then of wholeness. But let's just say that in the tragedy of it, and in that openness that comes when we are suffering and when we are anguished, when everything is kind of redefined and we're looking for new answers and new explanations and reaching out for new kinds of help and new kinds of compassion and new kinds of love, let's say that when that openness now, out of the tragedy itself, has presented itself, let's just say that something wondrous happens and we find somebody who loves us and makes us unafraid then of walking without the leg or whatever. Because love always casts out fear. That's inevitable. Love casts out fear. And man alive, you can stand the pains of life. It's the fears that you can't take. Man has an enormous capacity to stand pain. But pain is always multiplied by a fear factor. And when we are living as anxiety-ridden beings, then the pains get multiplied into just fantastic proportions. And every pain is a throbber until you find somebody who loves you. And then you can have the courage to face the pain, and we have enormous capacity for standing just plain unmultiplied pain. And I'm suggesting that we carry the concept of wholeness one step further and start talking about abundant living. A little bit of what I talked about last night, those tiny little crystals add a little bit of a hint of this great, big, fantastic creational grace of God with which we are so little acquainted, but which can add excitement to life and keep us from getting bogged down and get the blahs and get bored and then having to go to a hospital for a little drama in life. And I would still want to repeat that among the greatest of all sins is the sin of boredom. How can it be? Well, seen in this light, illness is more than something lacking or incomplete. Illness then becomes rather that which keeps the person from becoming free to be. To be that unique and magnificent being related on the one hand to the whole of creation by way of the ground from which we were drawn. We were formed out of the dust, the stuff of this planet. The stuff of this planet was called Adama in the Hebrew. We were then given the name of Adam because we came out of the Adama in the way the Hebrew language behaves itself, as though we were the sons of the earth. But remember, so was the elephant and so was the hippopotamus. Something else here. He breathed into our nostrils the breath of life, and man became the living soul. I think that means the imago Dei, or the image of God and living soul. I think that means we became persons as God is person. Sometime, if you get a chance, look up a little book that's now 10 years old by the English pastor Michael Wilson, in which he defines the Christian life and the church as healing. The title of the book, by Michael Wilson, The Church is Healing. I think he both expressed a hope and probably defined a little bit of its reality. But it is well worth reading. We who follow in his name and identify ourselves with the Christian congregation had better accept our role as healer. That's what it's all about. He came into this world to heal its brokenness and left us to carry out and to deliver and to tell of the power that accomplishes this. Well, the task in healing is not simply to look at somebody who is sick and then to restore them to some previous level of relative well-being. The Christian approach to health care accepts the broader and deeper goal of setting people free for new dimensions of self-expression, significance, and joy of living. I've been trying to suggest that we have uniquely significant and meaningful values to bring to a world very much in need of their healing potential. It is a world experiencing change at a fantastically accelerating rate. The rate of change frightens us all. There is too little time to decide whether the changes are good or bad. I have the feeling that they are mostly good. It is the rate of their arrival that disturbs. If we attempt to evaluate each change for its logical and ethical validity, we shall let 100 go by while we examine the one. Just for example, very few of us have made our final decisions on the question of abortion yet. Society didn't wait. But while we were so intensely preoccupied with the important consideration of the rightness or wrongness of abortion or revising the availability and under what circumstances, during that time, I think enormously large ethical problems were simply ignored by us all. Like, for instance, the things that some of my friends are now involved in considering as medical doctors. Edward Pellegrino, who is now at Yale teaching philosophy, medical doctor, previously a prominent medical dean in this country, but thinks that some kinds of new awarenesses have to be spelled out because of so many of these new ethical problems that are growing out of the rapid growth of technology. He's joined there by Jose Delgado. Delgado can control people and animals by pushing a little button. Some of you may have seen about 5 years ago when Delgado stopped an enraged bull after the picadors had fastened all those little barbs into the bull. And Delgado walked out in the middle of the bull ring and pushed a little button on a gadget the size of a pack of cigarettes. And the bull stopped and just stood there, calm, in the middle of his charge. Because Delgado had inserted just a tiny little pump down into the brain. And when he pushed the button, an electronic control squeezed the pump, and something hit a part of the brain that changed the rage and the anger and the fear and the terror of that bull into something like peace. I've seen Dr. Delgado control the mood of whole families of chimpanzees in similar ways. But he came to a meeting of theologians and scientists, and mostly futurists, at King of Prussia, Pennsylvania a few years back and told us that he must stop his research and his development of these things until he had the assurance that society would find some way of handling them with decency and a finely developed moral sense of their appropriateness. Otherwise, he must stop. Lest, he said, I find myself, Delgado speaking, in the position of Oppenheimer and the others before the atomic bomb. Well, somewhere we have to find a way of living in the midst of these great changes. We were helped, I think, falsely but somewhat helped in years by something called logical positivism, representing something of a way of life for the span of more than a generation. Things could be certain, things could be known, things could be sure. But that's now and appears to be a candle being extinguished by the gale of rapid change. Where are the essential verities? Where are the abiding truths? Where are the things that heal? I think we've been commissioned by God as Christians. Well, by both God and by the people about whom we are and should be concerned. I think we have been commissioned to speak to our society on their behalf. We have something to say to society that, for instance, carries, to a society that carries the guilt of the atomic bomb and the fear that even worse will be used again, a fear compounded by the realization that if we could do it, others surely can. Well, I keep mentioning God, and I guess for most of the world, and maybe for most of the country, he doesn't really have much to do with health, or isn't seen as having much to do with health. And I think that his exemption is because we've suckered in on Descartes' view of the fragmented human. So we could run off someplace and stick to, quote, spiritual things as our concern. It's a definition that God doesn't make in such limited terms. He even suggested we present our bodies as spiritual service. Remember? But the new view of man, a view that has been emerging, and to which Christians have significantly contributed, rules out this dichotomizing and fracturing of the human being. This new view of man states that man is unified and healthy if he is whole and full, and that illness is probably best described by brokenness. It is even amounting to something like a new theology, at least uncovering and making more conscious some aspects of theology that have been more or less neglected in the past. And in this new theology, quotes, man is a part of the whole of creation and one with the whole of creation. No longer can we put the soul on one side and the body at another removed position, or the Bible and the prayer book at some removed altar. It demands to be involved and to confront. And here we deal with a total man in his total environment. And coming back again, as you, forgive me, if you'll forgive me, to the medical and hospital model. Man in his total environment, and hospitals, surgical procedures, beneficial drugs, sophisticated laboratory instruments, bedpans, linear accelerators, seeing all of these as part of God's sacramental presence. Well, I kept you much too long. Let me just close by paraphrasing a little parable. I was growing old, and you minimized my degenerative processes. I was bedridden, and you provided a bedpan without degrading me. I had a malignancy, and you provided a linear accelerator. I was without direction, and you put my feet on the path of meaning and purpose in life. I was depersonalized, and you found me. I was fractured, and you put me together again. I was frightened, and you loved my fear away. I was at war with people and things, and you brought me a peace beyond all understanding. I didn't know myself, but you knew me, and I found myself. I was dying, and you showed me that it is not death to die. And then he said, "Inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. Go and be healers." You're a patient bunch of people.